for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 307 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I have a great interview with Richard Dent, the creator of a terrific Dynamite comic called Myopia. It's a great mix of sci-fi and steampunk and has a really interesting storyline going on. The first issue came out last year and the second one is getting ready to come out. In fact, it's time to order the second book in the 4-issue series. We talk about how the story came to be, about how as a poetry creator, he became a comics creator, and what kinds of things we can expect from Myopia in the near future. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Richard Dent, the creative force behind a book from Dynamite called Myopia. How are you doing today, Richard?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
It's good to talk with you. We were talking about just before I started to record the fact that I met you at San Diego Comic-Con this year. You were like a couple of aisles over from where I was at helping with a different book. And I bought your book because I was really interested in the concept. I love sci-fi type things. And your book has a really strong steampunk sci-fi kind of thing. So why don't you talk to people about what is Myopia?
Okay, well, Myopia is a story that I consider mostly speculative fiction. So it takes place around 200, maybe 300, I don't know, 200 to 400 years in the future. And everybody wears these sort of Google Glass type contact lenses. And then the government steps in and takes control of the company that makes the lenses. So that's my it's my kind of like elevator pitch is what I teach my screenwriting students. Another layer of the story is that this is like a post-energy crisis landscape. And in wake of that, a magnetic energy agreement has been created. And that magnetic energy agreement is basically to assure that the world is sort of using a balance of different energies. So this was something that, you know, is sort of like learned from the last energy crisis, which was implied that it was oil, because in the landscape of Myopia, oil is no longer a fuel source. Magnetic energy has replaced that portion of fuel.
Interesting. That's very timely as far as things go, because today's society, we're all worried about energy and where it's going to come from and things like that. So I think that's pretty cool. Now, before we get any farther, I didn't know what the word myopia meant. So I had to go online, and of course, I turn to the internet whenever I don't know what's going on. I don't always know after I get there, but this one kind of, it's interesting. Myopia is referred to as nearsightedness, but it's also considered to be lack of imagination, foresight, or intellectual insight, which kind of all ties into the stuff you were just talking about. And I was just, you know, I'm just fascinated by that. I mean, how did you come up with the name? We'll start with there.
You know, I had a couple different names for this story as I revised it. And I just, you know, was looking for a name. You know, you get that feeling when you're making a name that it's not just right. And I was working with the story with a couple different titles. And, you know, it just sort of nagged me. And then I don't know what happened. I don't know if it was going into the Kickstarter that finally made me sort of like, okay, I really need to take changing this title seriously. And I just, you know, thought about it. It just kind of came to me, like with the lenses and everything like that. I was thinking, well, that would be a good one. It's, you know, this is really the sort of theme of the story are these lenses and just basically the evolution of how dependent people get on apps and social apps and technology and sort of this whole concept that you know, they just sort of get into a tunnel vision with their own world in these social apps. And I just sort of all sort of came together with the lenses and everything and the deeper storylines and the issue. I'm a poet. Like when these things, when I get a good name, I'm like, I don't even understand it completely. I'm like, oh, that's going to work for this.
Cool. Well, that's the good thing is when you know it works, that's the important thing, especially as a writer, as you are.
Yeah.
Now, I want to get into I want to read this inside cover quote that I thought was really interesting. This originally designed as a piece of entertainment technology, the Formula Media Lens has been co-opted as a piece of government surveillance. Its influence now ubiquitous. A mysterious man and a young boy find themselves in a battle to save the world from a corrupt and complacent government. So I thought that was a real great way to put this together. Why don't we start to tell you, you've set the stage as far as the society goes. Can you talk a little bit about the people involved? Like, who are the folks that are involved in this?
Well, you have Bill Glenn and Molly Glenn. And Bill Glenn is the scientist whose life work has been making apps for the Formula Media Lens, apps that he feels are an actual attribute to society, because this landscape isn't there to sort of bash technology or bash apps. It's really sort of just more of an investigation into, you know, the benefits and the negatives of such things. So he worked on trying to make life better through these apps. So he would, you know, design sort of more sophisticated GPS apps and a lot of the things that we use today and that sort of thing. So he was sort of the main character in the first issue, in the first part of the first issue. And then his wife, Molly, she's the mom and the wife. And, you know, her character develops more as the series continues. But in the first issue, that's all she's really introduced as. And then you have Ledge Carver, who is Bill Glenn's boss and best friend, and he is the CEO of Formula Media, who makes the company that makes the lenses. Then you have James Chase, who comes on mid-issue, and he is a protege of Bill Glenn, and he steps into the story, and he sort of has this mysterious past, and his sidekick is Hudson Brown, the last surviving Falcon, and we don't really know that much about him, only that he knows a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've got to start out with how the book starts. It starts out with Bill's walking with another guy, and the guy says to Bill, he says, "Bill, I think you're the only person left in the world who writes anything down on paper." And Bill responds, "One big power failure, and boom, we're back to flint rocks and sundials." And that's an interesting way to start, because that's kind of the theme of this whole book, is that, you know, that sometimes we have to wonder what technology is doing for us and to us. And that's kind of one of the themes in this book that I came away from. And I really like the fact that you're dealing with a subject that right now is very important. You know, people are saying we shouldn't be on the iPhone so much and all this kind of stuff going on. Did that influence the putting together of this story?
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, actually, you know, going back to the title, I just felt it was a good title, but it really works on so many levels. In fact, a lot of people are getting myopia, which is that eye stigmatism, from their iPhones. Mm. I found out recently. So it's actually really bad for your eyes to be looking, actually physically bad for your eyes to be looking at computers and phones as much as we do. But, you know, I just really think that in that particular quote, like one of the themes that I'm sort of exploring is it's not just technology, but just the dependency in general that civilization has on energy, which goes back to the sort of the power failure concept and the magnetic energy agreement and that sort of thing. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, but like I live in Los Angeles and I live in an apartment, and I have a ton of stuff plugged in here, and I have like all the modern luxuries in my apartment. And I just think some days, like, God, if there was no electricity, I would be living in a box.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Now, there's an interesting panel that shows up. He's in a taxi cab going on there, this one guy is. And you see like CDs hanging from the roof.
Right.
At least what looks like CDs. And of course, that.
Yeah.
What's funny is you know, because CDs used to be all the rage, and even now it's starting to fade out. People don't buy CDs like we used to. And so this book kind of looks at a lot of the technology. And you've got like little hover cars going around in the future. But on some other levels, this future isn't all that different from where we are today. Do you want to talk about that kind of a setup, the sense that society may move technologically forward, but not necessarily in other ways?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's a good observation. Well, you know, that's why I like would consider the story speculative fiction, which is some of my favorite type of fiction. But, you know, you just kind of look at even at our own lives, you know, how you were just saying how CDs sort of are obsolete and that sort of thing. But I don't feel much different now than when I used to have a lot of those things, you know, like so at least we'll take music, for example. Now we stream music. We don't buy CDs. We don't join record clubs anymore where we get CDs sent to us and we stream music. But that really hasn't changed how I feel about music or how I listen to music. It's really just a different platform that the music is delivered to me on. And the thing is that's so annoying about, you know, technological advances is that they always have this trumpet coming along with them. Like, this is going to change everything. You know, everything is going to be different. And things don't change. You know, if you buy a book, whether you read it on a digital device or you have a hard copy book novel, you're still reading a book. You know, you're still experiencing the same sort of process. Your imagination is absorbing it. It serves the same function. It's either educating you or it's giving you some escape in one way or the other.
Now, there's something else I got to ask about, too, is that Bill goes around, but at certain points of the story when he's going along, he's got a bird, like a hawk or something, sitting on his shoulder, which, of course, makes him stand out from other things going on around him. Here we go. Where's my music clean?
By the way, I totally remember when you came up to my booth and that whole interaction, mm-hmm. but when I was sending out those emails, I just, you know, I'm in the throes of it right now, mm-hmm. and I was so happy to get your email back. I was like, oh, yeah, I remember all that.
What's interesting, what was making the noise was I was watching Star Trek Discovery on CBS All Access, and every once in a while it decides, well, it's time to start playing that. So I've got it stopped now, so we won't have that interruption any farther.
You're a prime candidate for the Formula Media Lens. You're multi-talented. Yeah.
It's just perfect because, you know, it's just the way the technology goes. I remember the first guy that ever sold me an iPhone, he said to me, this is going to change your life. And on some levels, he was absolutely right because now I can't get away from anything. People can contact me 24 hours a day. If I'm asleep, there are people sending me messages. All this kind of stuff now has changed in that respect. But you're right on the sense that other people have not changed, you know, in that sense. It's just funny to me as I look at this. I just can't help but think about how this is a great parable for what modern life is probably going to be for the longest time. I don't think we're going to change for hundreds of years. But anyway, yeah, the characters are really strong, and I like the fact that he's got a bird like that. Why does he have the bird on his shoulder?
Well, after the Kickstarter, I actually added the bird into the story because I was riding my bicycle here in the middle of Los Angeles. I was riding my bicycle and all these people were sort of waving at me. And, you know, you living in the city, you didn't ever trust anything like that. So I just ignored them. And then I actually wound up running over a falcon that was sitting in the bike path and I couldn't see it because it was so dark. It was a baby falcon. Oh. And I ran over its foot. Mm-hmm. And it jumped and it got hit by a car and then a car, but it actually, the cars weren't going that fast and the bird was fine. And we actually got it into a box and the bird was taken to a wild reserve and it's doing fine. But I was, you know, that moment like sort of stuck with me. Of course it was, you know, traumatizing, you know. And I just thought, you know, one of the things that as a big animal lover and my artist, Patrick Bergenkotter, he's a huge animal lover. I was just thinking one of the things what I also don't like about technology and civilization is how much they disregard nature and the animal kingdom. So after that experience, I was like, you know, I really think I want to weave a little bit of that concept into the story. And so I just had, you know, the main character have a sidekick. Mm-hmm. Which is a falcon. He's the last surviving falcon. So all the animals are extinct, which was already in the story. There was already the implication that there was a huge environmental disaster that went along with this power failure. But I didn't actually have a face for it. So
Well, one of the other things I enjoy about the book is that you've got James's resume all written out. You've got every detail in there. You actually get to read the resume, which a lot of people say, here's my resume, and you don't ever see anything. But you can sit there and read just about every word on the resume. So you must have developed that as part of the character to have his, because you knew you're going to need that somewhere in the story. What was it like to write a resume of a fictitious character?
It was fun. it was a pain in the ass, but it was fun. I don't even like writing my own resume, so it was pretty weird. But it was fun. I mean, I do a lot of that kind of thing in this story. I'm a huge Alan Moore fan. Mm. I love the way that he. I think that's the one thing that really drew me to this medium was the way that he would take items, music, sheets of music. He does that in B for Vendetta, all these different things like letters and diary entries and all that stuff. And he would just lay them out, you know, as part of the background of the story. And you can either choose to read it or not read it. And you're still going to sort of get the gist of the book and like it. But if you read it, it sort of feels more almost like a novel. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed writing it. It was cool.
Now, I've got to ask you, of course, I read somewhere that this wasn't originally a comic, that this was a screenplay. Was this intended for a movie? Is that what you were hoping to do?
Yeah, I'm like the most I'm an all over the place type writer. So I got my degree in poetry. And then when I was in graduate school, I took a year long screenwriting course with a Chesterfield fellow fiction writer. And I did that with a bunch of poets and fiction writers. And we were all, you know, I wasn't in L.A. I was living in L.A. and then I moved to Arizona to do my poetry degree. And so it was really kind of funny to be writing like I never wrote any screenplay when I was in the city. And then when I went to Arizona to study poetry, I was writing a screenplay. So it was just really weird. But anyway, with a bunch of poets and fiction writers who had no experience. So I didn't write it there. But when I came back to L.A., I was writing a lot of fiction and poetry, true to my nature. And then I just was like bored and I decided to pull out my screenwriting chops. And then I wrote this script and I entered it. I guess technically it was the second script I've ever written. And then I entered it into a bunch of screenwriting contests because that's the nature of a poet. We enter contests all the time. It's what we do. And I ranked really high in both of them. And I thought this is really cool. And I sort of met with a couple producers and I was like kind of turned off about how, you know, I kind of left a bad taste in my mouth. The way screenwriting works in this town is a whole nother story altogether. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to turn this into some sort of other medium because I really like this story. And comics was it. So
now, were you a comics fan before you did this?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have read a lot of graphic novels, but I've never been, to be honest, I've never been a sort of serial comic book, you know, Marvel or DC fan. Like I read them when I was kids and I've of course always watched the cartoons and the movies and that sort of thing. But I wouldn't call myself your typical like comic bookstore comic book person, but I definitely have been into comics my whole life, but not in your traditional nerd comic book store way.
Well, you know, I have to say that a comic book gives you an unlimited special effects budget. Whatever a person can draw or paint or whatever I would put on the page is possible. And I always also like to say that a comic is a guide for anybody who wants to make a movie or a TV show, because you're doing all this laying out and framing of sequences and all this good thing going on. So, you know, Myopia may not have seen the last of its thing of being a comic. It may actually turn out to be a great movie because I like the story. I think the story is really profound and really interesting. The people are the way that they interact with each other is really interesting because, you know, it's, you know, the fact that they have technology and you can see when somebody's interacting what they consider to be the internet, their eyes glow. And what I gather is everybody can see that. Is that just something for us, or if they're contacting the web or whatever it is, how do?
Yeah, you're bringing up a really interesting technical point because there's a lot of those moments that I think actually, you know, because it was originally a screenplay, will look fantastic if it ever turns into a movie because they're just all these these things happening simultaneously, you know, with the lenses, you know, conversations going on in the lenses, all these sounds and noises and effects and angles. But yeah, that's kind of how that works. So, you know, like kind of just like how our phones are, there are ways to hide your images and not, but you know, the whole idea is that people just don't care. You know, they're just so involved in their own world. They're not going to be looking at your lenses to see what's going on inside your lenses. But there are all these different, you know, ways to hide that information and that sort of thing, just like our phones. So.
Now, a lot of this story centers around James being hired by what looks to be a government agency. Do you want to talk about that? I mean, what the, you know, he's being hired to do something specific that he's got the skills for. I don't want to give away too much of the story, but what is it that they're trying to accomplish with him?
Well, actually, what's going on is that he's not being hired by a government agency necessarily. He's being hired by Formula Media. Oh. So Formula Media is, you know, like I said, is the place that makes the lenses. But since, you know, Bill's passing in the earlier issue, it has become a sort of like it's been sort of sequestered a bit by the government. Mm-hmm. So that's why you get that feeling that's a government agency in the book, but it has not been officially declared that. So he's really just being hired just like any Google tech nerd might be hired to sort of work on, you know, their lenses. And he has that background because he was trained by Bill. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's going to be really interesting because, you know, as the technology moves forward, it's going to be interesting to see how his influence happens. Now, one other thing before we leave the first issue is the boy who at the end is kind of going to end up being apparently a contrast to them. He ends up putting the lenses in. We actually watch him put the lenses in, which always makes me uncomfortable, which is why I don't have contact lenses. So I don't have that. But he puts them in and he gets sort of lost and stuff as things start to happen. But then we begin to see things take place that he sees, and I'm always wondering, is he seeing this for real, or is this something that's going to happen? Is the technology doing something to him that gives him a chance to see what might be happening? Towards the end, I mean, I don't want you to give away too much, but is this something that I guess maybe it's a little bit of both. What is actually this, and first, what's the boy's name again?
Matthew.
Okay. So what is Matthew seeing as we get towards the end? Because he's very surprised by all this. And he actually gets to see something at the very end. There's a great big cliffhanger at the end I would never spoil, which he sees a certain something that makes me just all the more interested. It looks like he's seeing James at a certain point. But more than that, I don't want to say. Yeah. But there's just a whole bunch of really interesting things going on with him. Is it because he's got some kind of connection to technology that makes him see these things, or is that something we're going to explore in the future?
Yeah, I mean, that's like, you know, this is the way that this story is sort of paced. It's, you know, since this whole comic has become part of my life, I've been able to start reading a bunch of other comics books from all different, you know, publishers like Valiant IDW and all those guys. And I realized that a lot of comics are real narrative. They want to make sure that you completely understand what's going on. There's a lot of like labeling and narration and explaining. But this story is, you know, a lot of the questions that you're asking me, I want you to not know the answer.
Okay. That's you as a writer are taking me down that path, because you know that's going to make me want to sit there and go like, now what? Now what? When I get to the end of the book, I'm going like, now what? What the heck is that all about?
Yeah, so, you're supposed to be really frustrated.
Good. Well, that I am, so that's good. You accomplished your goal there with that. But that leads us to the next thing, because you've got more myopia coming our way. One of the things you sent me an email, that's how this interview happened, was I remembered you from San Diego, and I just read your stuff recently. And I was just interested. You've got another book in this volume. Talk about the overall scope of myopia. How many books are in myopia? What's going on with that?
Well, I'm really excited because I took a purposeful long pause between the first issue and the second issue because, you know, going back to, you know, our previous discussion, this is sort of a new world for me as far as knowing how to do comic cons and how all the whole publishing experience works. And I just wanted to take a second to A, sort of get all my Kickstarter rewards out, and B, sort of do some interviews and go to some comic cons and go to some bookstores and do some signings before I started barreling forward with all this, because, you know, Dynamite, they're pros and they're just like, yeah, just keep going. And I'm like, wait, hold on, you know, kind of thing. And now that I sort of got it, I'm really excited because we're just going to go. And, you know, this, I already have, you know, most of this second issue pages in. And, you know, I just love Patrick's illustration. It's just so good. I can't be happier with working with him. I just am so lucky. And, you know, I just love the story at this point. So, I'm rambling because it's really exciting. But, everyone tries to nail. This is another thing I learned about comics. They're always trying to nail me down. Like, where are these one shots? Is this going to be monthly? It's going to be, you know, how long is this going to be? And I am not coming from that background. So I just sort of look at them like, well, I mean, it's going to be, I know it. I know the end of the story is written already and it's going to come out. I just don't want to, I don't really know why I have to tell you when it's going to come out. Don't worry about it. But I would say to satisfy that need, probably like every 3 months, and it's going to be definitely 4 issues, will be the end of this first big chunk of the story. And from there, we're going to figure out what to do next.
Okay. Well, let me tell you a quick story or two, just so you'll understand where comic people come from. Because what happened was you know who Frank Miller is. He wrote a series called Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah.
And I remember I bought the first issue, and the second issue came out a month later. The third issue came out 6 months later.
Okay. See, I already love him even more now.
And then the last issue a year after that. Now, as a comic reader, remember, comics are habitual medium. We buy things out of habit. We go every week to the comic store because we want to get stuff. And if something disappears, sometimes we lose it in our heads.
Right.
So anyway, I remember getting that fourth book. And I remember sitting there and reading it and being like, I thought I was never going to see this in my lifetime. I thought I was never going to get this. And I was so enamored by it. And I loved it so much because I liked that whole story. And I'm a big Batman fan anyway. So I would like that. So this, if you wonder why comics fans are that way, it's because we forget. We're forgetful when these things kind of happen.
I see.
One other thing, I'll throw one other point in real quick, and I'll, you go ahead and do it, is that oftentimes people will put the numbering on the book, like Myopia would be number one. And the second book, which has a subtitle, Myopia : The Rise of the Domes, would have two, so that we know what order things go in.
We're so annoying, aren't we?
So anyway, I just thought I'd point it out. Go ahead. You were going to say something.
Nothing. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I'm definitely going to be getting the rest of the story out much sooner this time around. So this is not going to be some just like artistic tantrum. Like, everything's written already. Mm-hmm. I just need to, you know, work in some of the newer ideas that I, you know, like I told you, I added Hudson Brown into the story so that I have to work some of that into the remaining issues. He's already all throughout issue 2. But, you know, I also really want to respect my illustrator's process. I mean, Patrick has worked for Marvel, and he's done, you know, he's a seasoned illustrator, and he knows how to do serial work or work faster. But I think he's really, really putting all of his effort into this, and I don't want to rush him. You know, I don't want to bug him to death. I mean, I do bug him, believe me. We bug him a lot to get moving, but what he does is hard. You know, it's not, I don't think it's really healthy for artists to have publishers breathing down their neck, and this is a creator-owned property, so we have a little bit of flexibility to have a little bit of time, but it's still going to come out real fast now.
Okay. Well, that'd be good. And the important thing, another thing that's good to know, is that if you tell us when stuff's going to happen, as long as you meet those things and we understand, okay, in 3 months I'm going to get the next issue, we're pretty happy with that. I mean, we want the story.
Okay. Yeah.
That's what we want.
Well, this next interview that I'm doing with ComicCon.com, I'm being asked all these questions, and I'm committing to some extent, like to 3 months, I guess. Mm-hmm. Every 3 months we'll do that.
Well, if it's not going to be there, tell us. Get out on the web and use social media and whatever you have to do. You do the very thing that you're
okay.
and tell us. Just tell us, oh, we're running late. It's going to be a month late. And we'll all go, okay. Particularly if we love the story. And I did want to mention how much I really like Patrick's artwork. It's very realistic, and yet it's got that futuristic feel to it that I really like. Like the cover for the second one is really, really sharp. It's got him in some kind of a flying device, apparently, and the hawker, whatever that is with him. And he's being chased by somebody. And you can see in the background on this tower a woman with the glowing eyes. So I really like that. I think that's you're building on what we know from the first issue and adding some action and some real interesting things going on to it. So I thought his artwork just sparkles. I really like the way he does it.
Yeah, well, this story is laid out in the first issue, and it's you know, it's a slow build, but the action ratchets up real fast. So that's why the second issue cover is so busy, because the second issue is when things start getting busy. So
good, good. Now, as I understand it, the price for the second issue is going to be $4.99. It's going to also be coming out in February. Now, when books come out this far in advance, they notice. It says on it February 28th, but whenever I see that, that warns me that it could come out the month of February, but don't know exactly when yet. They're just covering their bases on that. So now,
are you asking me when it's going to come out in February?
Well, I'm guessing you probably don't know at this point.
Well, it's not really my call, okay. You know, like it's really about what how Dynamite figures it out. But as far as the issue being completed, we're almost there now, and it's only December, so I don't think it's going to be a problem.
Good. And we're looking forward to that. Now, another important thing we have to bring up is the fact that there's a deadline for people to turn in their requests for this. Get your local shop, and of course, go to your local shop and ask them to order Myopia, The Rise of the Dome, so that you can get that. And they have to turn it in by a certain day. What day is that in the month of December they have to do that?
So December 18th is the universal deadline for customers to turn their orders in to the booksellers. I think booksellers might have a little bit extra time, but I wouldn't push them on that because some of them – you know, some of them won't honor the request. So I would say the 18th is for customers.
I'm looking. The 18th is a Monday. So that'll be ending by Monday the 18th. No later than that. Well, of course, you want to get it in ahead of the 18th because the store has to let Diamond know so they can put the orders in and make sure that everybody gets their stuff. So I would say the week before, let your comic shop know that you want to get this book from Dynamite and things like that. So it'll be a good thing. No,
I was just going to say, yeah, it's really important that that if you're interested in the book to get your orders in, because otherwise we sold out of the first issue. I don't know if you were going to bring this up, by the way, that we are actually because we did sell out of the first issue, you are able to order the first issue and the second issue at the same time in December.
I was just going to ask that. How do you get the first issue? Because nobody wants number two without number one. So that's a great way to do. So you can, if you place the orders to the comic shop, they can order number one as well.
Yeah, we're doing a reprint, and we're playing with the idea of maybe doing a different style cover. And I'm not saying a variant cover, but we might reprint it with like a different style because it's going to be a second printing. But yeah, they each have their own separate order codes, and they're both on page 330 of the previews catalog. So cool. You can just go in and look at them both.
Well, great. Now, of course, I have to congratulate you. Not many people first comic book sells out. So that's a great sign that this is a good story. It lets people know this is a good thing, and it's good for people, particularly if you like steampunk, or if you like me, you like speculative future fiction like I do. It's a great thing to get into because it's going to take you places, and it's going to deal with subjects that I don't know many comics do. So I think that's a great thing. So I'm really happy about that. So again, by the 18th, the store has to put the order in. So I would say get to your shops this week and get it in so that people can get it out and get it done so that they have the book ordered in time, because that's an important thing. So you're saying 3 months pretty much, unless something changes, we can expect to see the next couple chapters after this.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as the last page is turned in for this book, which is almost is, I'm going to start in on the next issue. So it's definitely 3 months. I mean, it could be sooner, you know. Mm-hmm. It just that's why, you know, I don't like to commit to these things. You know, you never know. It could even be sooner. But I would say 3 months is a safe bet.
Okay, this now leads to the next question. If we want to keep up with what you're doing on Myopia and maybe other stuff, how do we do that? Are you on social media like Facebook and stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm like all over the place. You just want to go to my website, richdentwriter.com. And, you know, if you scroll to the bottom, you can get to my Facebook, my Instagram, and my Twitter. And I post, usually when it comes to book signings and conventions that I'm attending, they're going to be on my Facebook page. But I will also put that directly on my website as well. So
very good. Very good. And, of course, Dynamite has your stuff up there, too, as far as a thing like that. You went to San Diego this year. Are you planning to do more conventions next year?
I am going to WonderCon. It was confirmed, and then now it's not. But now, like, I got a table there, and then I got an email like from the people saying I'm on a wait list, and the guy who organized it's like, you're not supposed to be. So, but anyway, I'm going whether they like it or not. So I'm gonna be at WonderCon for sure, and then I'm probably most likely gonna be at San Diego. I just don't know where. I don't know if I'm gonna have a table again. I might just do the autograph section. And then I'm gonna try and shoot for New York this year.
I would.
I really want to go out there.
Yeah, because a lot of things happen. You know, of course, San Diego, same setup. There's a lot of behind the scene things that happen with creators and companies and things like that. Because you're all in the same place, everybody gets a chance to talk to each other, and things start to happen as a result of it. So I highly recommend that, because New York is my favorite one of all of them. Now, San Diego is great. I've been there twice so far. The first one, it took me a couple of weeks to recover, because I was walking all over downtown San Diego, going to hotels and restaurants and all kinds of stuff where comic things were happening. And it literally took me like 2 weeks to get my sea legs back after all that walking around and doing stuff. New York's not quite this stuff, because, you know, in San Diego, it takes over downtown San Diego.
Right.
If you go to New York, most people in New York don't even know it's there, you know, because New York is a huge place with lots of things going on.
I'm kind of scared to go to New York. My book agent in New York said that the convention center is kind of a nightmare. So,
well, you know what? They're in the middle of construction. Like this past year, for example, they had the year before, they had all the artist alley in a separate part of the building that they're now doing construction. At least they were this year. Don't know what they'll be doing next year. And so that reduced the number of booths they could have in artist alley this past year, which made it really tight to go along. They also did another thing that's interesting to be aware of. Instead of offering 4-day passes, they made it so that people could get 1- and 2-day passes, and they rarely gave out 4-day passes. But
that's a bummer.
Well, but the good news was, and I talked to Neil Adams about it, and he said how happy he was with it. The reason is because more people got to come. And when more people got to come in there, they got more people buying things. If you were there Thursday, and that was the only day you were there, you bought what you could because you weren't going to be back there the next day.
Right. And I grew up in Philadelphia, so I'm a total mid-Atlantic person. So I mean, growing up, I would totally go up to New York for one day if I got a 2-day pass to go see a Comic-Con, you know? So it's definitely, I can see that working out. I really want to go, I have a lot of friends and family who still live in the East Coast, and it's not out of my comfort zone at all. I just haven't yet, you know? So, but I definitely want to.
It's definitely worth it, I think. And I don't, you know, there's this mass of people going, you know, in and out of the convention. So I never feel afraid, you know, walking the streets of New York, because, you know, there's so many of us. And there'll be a lot of people in costume going along. And so you are just, you know, I was riding in the subway one time, and there was a guy dressed up like the Hulk, and nobody even noticed him. It was the funniest thing.
That's pretty funny.
So it's a pretty, you know, that's New York City for you. They just don't pay attention to those kinds of things. And, you know, you literally walk on several, you get exercise too. It's a good thing to be able to get the walking and stuff like that too. But it's a fun place to be. And now, just like San Diego, what's starting to happen is events are starting to take place outside the convention center.
Really? Wow. Okay.
So that's going to be something interesting as we move forward to see how they deal with all that. Because before, everything was contained in that one building. And once you got in that building, you knew you were going to get to everything. But now there are other places that are starting to have events in conjunction with that.
Okay.
So that'll be something to see. But honestly, New York is just this great place. It's just, there's so many interesting things going along.
Yeah.
It's just great.
I had my eye on doing the Emerald City Comic Con too, but the thing is that it's sort of in the same month as WonderCon.
Oh.
I am still not as good as other people. Like, I know people go to these conventions every weekend, and I have a full-time job, so... But I heard that's a really good one, too.
Yeah, that's a great one. Actually, believe it or not, I'm going to get to go to that one the way it stands right now. There are, every weekend, at least 2 to 3 conventions being held. And they're all over the place.
Crazy.
It's just, and the amazing thing, well, some of them are even in the same locations, like same regions. Like, I live in Central Florida, and as such, there are sometimes conventions in Tampa and Miami going on at the same time. And I'm going, that's only like 3-hour drive between them.
Right.
Why are we doing that? You know, I think it's going to, it waters both of them down in my estimation. So I know.
That just happened out here with Long Beach Comic Con and LA Comic Con. There's those two, and you know, they're like the local ones here. And I feel like if you offer too many cons around you, people just, I don't know. It's, it waters it down.
You got to make a choice. I mean, you can't go to both of them, most likely. You're probably going to choose one. And the moment you do that, you've got only about, if you're lucky, 50% of the people going.
Yeah. Are you going to go to WonderCon, or is that too far?
It's a little far for me. I'm not even sure I'm going to make it to San Diego again this next year, but I want to. I have friends that are going, and I might have to hook a ride with them and do stuff so I can go and do that. But I'm hoping to be able to go there. WonderCon, I have a lot of friends who really love WonderCon, but I just haven't been able to work out getting there yet.
The nice thing about WonderCon is that if you do decide to go, it's kind of a, you know, it's the same people who do Comic-Con. So they have, it's a mini version of that. And Anaheim is so cheap compared to San Diego. Like, you can get a hotel for $99 a night. So
If you're going to go to San Diego, you have to already have your hotel room reserved for this coming. In fact, usually the moment the hotels become available, you have to make your reservation.
I don't even want to start bitching about San Diego Comic-Con.
Well, you know, it is the Comic-Con, you know, let's face it. It's the one that everybody talks about. And New York, I think, is getting closer to that. But even though I think they actually get more people at New York Comic-Con, I think that the San Diego is still the premier one. So
yeah, and you have to understand, San Diego, you know, like, it's not just the Comic-Con. That city, when they put the Comic-Con on, the city is almost like, I feel like I'm in a small world. It's like, you know, so picturesque, and it's fairly safe, and you can just sort of walk all over the place. And I mean, it's almost like a fantasy land, you know.
Well, the weirdest thing for me, and we'll get back to your stuff in a second here, but I'm walking around San Diego the first time, and after like 3 or 4 days of it, I actually get a little weirded out by everybody walking around in costume. I mean, there's so many people going around in costumes. I start to go, you know, this is something strange. After 4 days of that, I started to feel a little out of place.
I know. Well, I stay. Well, I'm not going to tell you where I stay because I don't want everybody staying there. But I stay a little bit outside of the downtown area, and it actually makes it much more enjoyable for me.
That's good. Well, I could go into stories about San Diego, but I won't. But anyway, let's get back to what you're doing. My understanding is you're a teacher, right? You teach writing now?
I do. I teach at Cal State LA. I just had final exams today, so that's the end of that. And then I also teach in the National University MFA program. That's an online program, and National University is based in San Diego, but they're all over California and Nevada. They're sort of like a University of Phoenix kind of concept. Cool. You know? Yeah. I think they're one of the only totally online MFA programs out there.
Well, cool. Now, question is, are you going to teach your book? Are you going to take your book to class and ask people to go over it, and are you going to teach from it and say, this is how I did this, well, and this is how you do that?
That's considered very bad form. But okay. If you know any professors who'd like to teach my book, you're more than welcome to suggest it. But no, I mean, in the like at Cal State, I'm teaching undergraduates, and then when I teach graduates, I'm teaching fiction and poetry. So they try and get into my book because everybody loves comic books, and everybody really gets into Myopia because it's, you know, it's really a different kind of comic book, and you know, it's got hardcore comic book fans really like it, and then people who really like literary fiction and, you know, are sort of like getting into the comics more, and this is the kind of book that they sort of gravitate towards. So I have to kind of push away from that when I'm teaching fiction and poetry because it's not on the curriculum. Now, when I – like right now, I just started teaching screenwriting in the National University MFA program, and most of my students are published fiction writers taking a screenwriting class. And we will talk about my book more in this class because I feel like the process that they need to go through in order to translate – their way of thinking about fiction to the more minimalistic screenplay form. I can use comics as an example a lot because it's you need to do that with panels. You really need to be minimal. I wouldn't say minimalistic, but you really have to be careful about what you just put in and out of the scene, you know, take in and out of the scene. So now,
is Myopia going to keep you busy for a while as far as comics go? I mean, is this going to – obviously you want to get the 4 issues done. Are you working on other projects? Do you have other things that you want to do as well?
Myopia is keeping me busy for a while. I have a novel every time I almost finish it, another issue of Myopia sort of crops up. So it's like, and then it takes over my life, which is what's happening right now. But I do have a literary novel, so it's really not anything about like what myopia is, ready for my agent soon. Then I also have another novel that I was working on before that, which is could be completed sometime soon. And that's definitely more in the fantasy realm, speculative sort of science fiction realm. But I want to keep working in comics. I really do like it, you know. Really do like this.
It's different. Now, the final thing I want to do is I wanted to point out you did a Kickstarter. And as such, it says that you were supported by such people as George R.R. Martin, Neil Gaiman, Margaret Atwood, Dean Koontz, and Jim Butcher. Boy, that's a good list of people to be supporting you. How about that?
I mean, it's not like they moved in and paid my rent, lodges, you know, but we did talk and they, you know, we did communicate and they did give me items for the Kickstarter, rewards for the items that were specifically tailored for the Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Margaret Atwood, which she never does stuff like that. And that was just, I know that, you know, Margaret Atwood has a background in comics. She just did that comic with Dark Horse called Angel Catbird, I believe. Right. And then she, you know, has done like comic strips when she was younger. Mm-hmm. But, you know, her whole thing is The Handmaid's Tale and literary novels and stuff. So she's a big speculative fiction writer. So she gave me the books that were in that genre. She actually gave me a comic book that she did with a famous Canadian artist, and they both signed it. And his name is not ringing a bell right now because it's French. So I apologize for not remembering that right now. But it was like really long. And then she gave me The Handmaid's Tale signed, and then Orcs and Crake. And then something else she gave me too, but these were all books that related to my Kickstarter. George R. R. Martin gave me Wild Cards, and then a signed copy of Wild Cards, and then another one of his signed novels. And he also works with Dynamite, and that was kind of the connection there. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Dean Koontz, I wrote him a letter. He wrote me back in a very encouraging letter, and that was really awesome. And he's done work with Dynamite as well. And Neil Gaiman was really, really supportive, and I also reached out to him, and he gave me so much stuff. But, you know, he's just the nicest guy. Like, he supports a lot of people, so...
Well, the one, of course, I'm most interested in is Jim Butcher, because he does the Dresden Files.
God, I totally forgot him. Sorry. He's great. I absolutely love his Dresden Files series. It's awesome. You know, he himself is a firecracker of a personality.
Yes, he is. One of my hopes is to interview him at some point on this podcast. Your connection to him probably is through Dynamite. Dynamite does original Dresden Files stories that are not in the novels or anywhere else.
Yeah, that's what's so cool, you know. And then so his novels are great, and then those are really good. Dynamite did a great job on those, so they're definitely worth checking out. And then he had a TV show actually for mm-hmm. a second, mm-hmm. And that is also very good.
Mm-hmm. Well, the guy who is on Arrow was Harry Dresden.
Yeah, he's really nice too.
Yeah, really good stuff. So, anyway, you know, Richard, you're doing wonderful stuff. I can't wait to read more of your stuff. When this comes out, we won't have to talk again, because then I can talk a little more about what's coming in the second issue, which is going to be fun. But Myopia is this one great book that is fun to read, particularly if you like your brain stretched in a couple different ways, which is the way I like it. And I love the steampunk aspect to it and the sci-fi aspects to it. It's all great stuff. And commentary about today, which, you know, a comic should make us think. That's how I got into comics when I was a kid. Gardner Fox would teach me science in Justice League of America. And so now when I read your book, I'm reminded of him doing those things, because I learned something and I get to enjoy a story at the same time. It's great stuff.
Oh, thank you so much. That means a lot.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Until next time, keep reading your comics.